It's 5.5 minutes after three. Let's take a quick look at that weather forecast again. We're looking at rain showers with highs 45 to 50 for the rest of the day. Southeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting to about 45. Those winds will die off tonight to around 15 in the afternoon and then through the evening. And then tonight it's supposed to be cloudy, scattered rain showers. Those will mix with snow showers late. Lows around 36, light winds. And then Wednesday we're looking at rain showers with a snow level to 700 feet in the morning. Highs around 47. Southeast winds up to 10 miles per hour, increasing to southwest in the afternoon. And then Wednesday night, rain likely with lows around 35, and southeast winds about 10 to 15 miles per hour. So the next couple of days are going to be a little blowy and even a little bit of snow. 6 minutes after three now. Well, as I said, my guest is Rowdy Gaines, and he's here in town to do a speech as part of the Pillars of America series, which is put on by the Rotarians here in Juneau every year. And this will be tomorrow at 11 o'clock. The doors open up at 11:15. They say get in the line at 11, and then they'll have lunch served by the hangar ballroom. And then at 12 o'clock, we'll hear Rowdy Gaines speak. Rowdy, welcome to Juneau.
Thank you, Pat. Good to be with you.
Hey, I hear you came in the middle of the night and were quite surprised to be here.
A little tough getting here from Orlando, Florida, let me tell you, all in one day. But it was funny. We were just talking right before we went on air about how a warm of a feeling I had when I got off the plane. I travel all over the world, and fortunately, because of swimming, I've been able to do that. But it was just something special when I got off the plane here. I've never been to Alaska, and to experience this, I've heard so many great things. My wife's sister, my sister-in-law, lived here for 15 years, and she kept talking about how great it was and that she missed it so much. But unless you really experience it. And I've only been here for, 15, 16 hours,
yeah.
So I haven't been here long to really enjoy it. But I got a special feeling when I got off the plane, no doubt.
I've heard that before. There's something, I think, there's a big thing about Alaska, but there's also something really warm about Juneau, because we're isolated here and we're cut off. The ways you get in here are on an airplane and a boat. It's the only way you can come to Juneau. And there's something about the way we welcome people, I think.
You're right, Pat. It's the people. That's what I noticed more than anything, because I lived in Colorado Springs for 5 years, so the mountains and everything, very, very beautiful. And this is obviously gorgeous when you walk off. But for me, everybody I've met along the way has been so nice and warm and welcoming. And so it really, I noticed the people more than anything when I got off the plane.
Well, I'm sure you're also enjoying our wonderful, warm, Florida-like weather.
That is getting a little time to get used to, Pat, to tell you the truth. You know, born and raised in Florida. I'm a third-generation Floridian. I left the airport when it was 95 degrees yesterday, so it was a little bit different than walking off the plane. But, you know, I lived in Colorado for a long time, so I got a little adjustment. It was not too bad.
You've really had a variegated career. You've played many different roles, but the core of them always has been your athletic performance. I think in your biography it said you tried a whole bunch of different things before you dove into your first swimming pool.
Yeah, when I got to high school, I didn't start swimming until I was 17.
Yeah.
I was a junior in high school, and the reason was because I had tried out for five different sports before that: football, baseball, basketball, golf, and tennis, and each one I got cut in. I don't know about high schools around here, but in my high school, if you weren't good enough, you didn't get to play. But I never gave up. You know, I really loved athletics, like you said. I love sports, and I wanted to give swimming a shot. And swimming I kind of took for granted because I was born and raised around it so much. But the day I started swimming was the day I started, you know, falling in love with it and developing this huge passion for it.
And did you know how quickly after you hit the water the first time did you know you were gifted?
Well, I knew within a couple of weeks that I had a gift. There was no doubt, because a very quick story. The day I started swimming, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to do the proper technique. The coach of the swim team was also the football coach who had cut me just a few months earlier. And we went to the swim meet, Pat.
So you had a relationship.
Yes, I had a relationship. I knew him when I walked in. I go, oh, I didn't know who it was. Oh, no, this guy's already cut me. And he was just itching to cut me again. But I went to the swim meet about 2 weeks after I joined the team. And he put me on an E relay. Well, an E relay is not A, B, C, or D relay. I was on the relay with the other geeks and band members and chess club members, and we weren't
the
very
guys
good.
Like me. Yeah.
I was one of them. Yeah. Trust me, I was definitely one of them. But I outsplit every single person on the team. My 50 split on that relay was faster than anybody else on the team on any other relays. And that moment was the moment of kind of the light bulb going off saying, you know, I think I belong in this sport. And my coach looked at me with big old eyes after I finished the race, and we both said, you know what, this is your sport. And from that moment on, things just kind of took a rocket ship ride skyward for at least for the next 2.5 years.
Now, it's never just the athletic skill. It's also the coaches. So who was it that you said when you started you had no technique?
Right.
How did you develop the technique?
A lot of it was my high school swimming coach. You know, he was a football coach. He was new to it as well. It was only his second season of coaching swimming, so he didn't really know what he was doing, admittingly so, back then. And so he studied, we studied, we bought books, we went to the library. There wasn't so much videos back then, but we really, this was 1976, by the way. So, but we really studied. We were both students of, we became students of the sport. And I just tried to digest as much about the sport of swimming as possible, including technique work. And that's what I kind of worked on that first year or two was the technique part.
So then comes Auburn, right?
Then came Auburn, yeah. Okay. I went to school at Auburn, got a scholarship there. And it was also a very good swimming school. It had finished fifth in the country the year before I got there. My freshman year, we finished second in the country. So we were a very good swim team. There were a couple Olympians on that team. And so I really grew and learned a lot from them as well.
And again, a new coach.
And he had a new coach who was an incredibly bright coach, and in fact today has been the head coach of an Olympic team now, I think 4 or 5 times, but back then he was still a young coach coming up, but he's one of the best coaches in history now to this day.
So now we're almost up to 80.
Up to 80
and
almost.
You're doing races around the country, you're picked for the Olympics team.
Yeah.
And it looks like you're on your way.
Yeah.
It all got
taken away from us, so to speak. In 1980 we had the Olympic boycott, where our country decided not to go to the Olympic Games. And because of the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union, and I'll offer that little history lesson as well, you know, obviously, but for those that don't know it, the Olympics were supposed to be in Moscow, and our country felt like it was a decision to pull out of those Olympics, so we did. And it was very tough because in my sport, swimming, Pat, we only have the Olympics as the pinnacle of success. There's no Super Bowls or World Series, which you have every year. The Olympics is every 4 years, so that 4-year journey for me all of a sudden started turning into an 8-year journey.
So now you enter your next career as a gas pumper.
Yeah, that's right.
Working for your dad, I think.
Yeah. I worked for my dad, and I worked odd
and quit
jobs.
Swimming.
Well, I quit swimming after my senior year, which was 1981. Mm-hmm. So I went ahead and swam my senior year in college, which was 80-81, and then after that I quit for about 6 months and worked as a I worked in McDonald's flipping burgers. I worked as a lifeguard. I worked pumping gas. But my father came to me and said, you know what? Are you going to be able to look at yourself in the mirror the rest of your life? Are you going to be able to listen to that Olympic theme or watch an Olympic commercial or see those Olympic rings the rest of your life without having regrets? And I started really thinking about it, and I said, no, I'm not. He said, are you going to live another 60 years? And I said, I hope so, yeah. And he said, well, that means for the next 60 years, you got to think of it. Can you sacrifice 3.5 years or 3 years of your life now to be able to have that dream? And I came back.
So you came back. Did you find someone to help you, to help bring you back?
Well, my coach at the time was a new coach that had come in, because my old coach that coached me my freshman year in college moved on to another college. My new coach was Richard Quick, who's I won 3 gold medals, and I gave one of my gold medals to him. The other 2 I gave to my parents.
So what did Quick do with you? I mean, how did he change what you did?
What did he do? He believed in me.
Okay.
Man, he believed in me. That was the real key, is he was so positive. And I think you really need that. It's in any walk of your life, you need to have that positive energy around you, because the negative energy can bring you down. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not trying to get into any of these cliches and stuff, but it's true. And my coach always took something positive out of anything that happened to me in a negative way. The boycott, loss in a race. Believe me, I lost a lot of races. I lost the World Championships in 1982 by 3/100ths of a second, which is about a little fingernail traveling at that speed. So there were many ups and downs I had along the way, but he always tried to make lessons learned out of those valleys. And that really helped me in that path in 1984, at least to try to stay focused as much as possible.
Now, you're looking back on this now as an older person who has
older.
The perspective of time.
Careful.
Okay. But when you lost those races,
yeah,
they must have you must have been crushed a few times.
Absolutely.
And so this guy is the guy who basically put his arms around you and picked you back up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which you got to have.
So absolutely.
That's got to be somewhere.
No question about it. And as I said, of the three Olympic gold medals I won, I gave one to my mom, one to my dad, and one to my coach, because those were the three most instrumental people in my life, in my career, in helping me who I am today. You know, like I said, along the way, I made lots of mistakes, lost a lot of races, but those three people I was able to rely on a lot. My coach, obviously, in my swimming career, and then, you know, my personal life, my parents were a big influence.
Mm-hmm. And then 84, of course, you're on the podium.
Yeah, it was a great Olympics, because I'm sure you remember it was an Olympics that our country was sort of starving for. It was during that whole patriotic era of Reagan in 84 and the Olympic and the Soviets being an evil empire, and having the Olympics at home was something special. Mm-hmm. and to be able to stand on that podium and to be able to represent my country was an amazing feeling and an amazing honor.
So after the Olympics, you're an Olympic champion, you've achieved all of the dreams that your father was talking to you about.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next? What do you do?
It's strange, isn't it? Because so many athletes get into this feeling of, what do I do now? Because there's such focus. You know, you put these blinders on for 8 years. Well, for me, it was 8 years. But for many, it can be a lifetime anyway, at least a lifetime of going for a Super Bowl or doing something like that. And then all of a sudden you retire and you're twiddling your thumbs saying, what do I do now? Well, I had a college education. I did go to college. I graduated. I graduated in telecommunication. My father was a motion picture director, so, you know, I could have gone into that part. But the Olympics changed my life. It took me into a different direction. You know, I started building this brand of being able to be trusted, and the fact that I had a story to tell and a story of perseverance, I think. I hope to think that anyway, and of never giving up on your dreams. And if anybody's a living proof of that, I am, because I started late, I suffered through a boycott, and later on in my life, I suffered through an illness as well.
And that illness came when you were, what, 35, I think?
I was 32. Oh. I was 32. Close. I was 32. It was 1991, summer of 91.
And basically your whole body was paralyzed.
Yeah. Well, it's called Guillain-Barré syndrome. It's two French guys that discovered it, Guillain-Barré. And it's a neurological disorder that strikes your nervous system. What it does is it destroys the sheath around your nerve and basically short circuits your nervous system. So literally, I was walking around one day, and then within 24 hours, I was completely paralyzed. I started getting this pins and needles feeling like when your foot falls asleep, in my hands and feet, and all of a sudden, I'm completely paralyzed. And spent about 6 months in the hospital and had to kind of relearn how to do everything all over again.
Yeah.
It was a very strange.
Including
disease.
Teaching yourself how to eat with a fork again. I mean, it's that much. You've lost total body coordination.
Yes, total. I was completely paralyzed from head to toe. Yeah,
that's amazing.
So it was, and the strange part about it, and the strange part was the fact that it happened so suddenly, and the fact that you don't know how you get it. It's not a contagious disease. It's autoimmune. You don't catch it. And still to this day, my doctors have never told me how I got it. They think you get it after you've had a cold or a flu and it mutates into this virus. I had one doctor say I got it from mercury poisoning because I was in Japan during that incubation period. So I don't know. I don't know how I got it. It strikes 1 in 100,000. It's a very strange disease, but I made a recovery. And today I'm
not,
you know,
just a recovery. I mean, you're still doing world-class times in your age group.
Yeah, I swim master swimming now, and And master swimming's fun. It's for old people. And you swim against people your own age. But there's millions of master swimmers out there. And so I'm in the, I hate to say it, but I'm in the 50 to 55 or 50 to 54 age group now. And I swim against, you know, guys my own age. And it's really a lot of fun. And then you get to stay in the sport. I still swim every day. And in fact, I'm bugging Jamie here sitting next to me about swimming today and tomorrow. Uh-huh. So, and I'm going to be doing a little swim clinic a little bit later on. And so it's a passion still for me today. It's the only thing I'm any good at, Pat. So I love to swim.
I don't think so. I think you're good at telling a really incredible life story. And I hope lot of people come out to hear you tell that story to us. And again, there are still tickets available. They're at Hearthside. There are some tickets that are going to be for sale at the door. But the Pillars of America is a really popular thing. All the tables fill up in Juneau. So if you want to go, you need to be there at 11 o'clock outside the door in the line. They'll open the doors at about 11:15. There are, I don't think, any reserved tables. So basically, you go in and find a place to sit. Right. Lunch will be served at 11:30, and Rowdy Gaines will tell his story to us at noon tomorrow in the Centennial Hall.
Thank you
so much. I hope you enjoy your time here in Juneau. I hope you get a chance to do a little swimming.
I will.
You can probably just step outside and take a couple of strokes if it starts raining.
In fact, I was asking Jamie. I said, "Do people swim in that little inlet right there in the summer?" I'm going, I don't think I'll be doing that today, though.
No, I don't think you will. And we do swim in that inlet in the summer, but we wear rubber suits when we do because it'll kill you. Okay, well, thank you so much
thank
for joining
you, buddy.
Me today.
Appreciate it.
Music by the Avalon String Quartet, playing a section of Beethoven's String Quartet number, Opus 18, number 2 in G major. And with me in the studio is a member of that quartet, Anthony DeBois. You're the viola player. Hi, Anthony.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So, Avalon is here for part of the Juno Jazz and Classics sequence, and you have a big concert coming up Thursday night, but you've already played a couple of venues in Juno since you've been here.
Yeah, we did. We played at the St. Teresa Shrine, two concerts of the same program on Saturday, and we've been interspersing that with some other smaller events, a coffee concert at the Horizon Cafe, and a concert this morning at the State Office Building atrium for young and old alike. People of all ages were out on their lunch hour and stopped to listen. And we've also been visiting some schools in the area, some elementary schools, Harborview and Floyd Dryden Middle School out by the glacier yesterday. So working with some of the kids in the area.
Avalon is from the Chicago area.
Yeah, we are the string quartet in residence at Northern Illinois University, which is in DeKalb, which is about 60 miles west of Chicago. But we all live closer to the city, and our home performing base really is Chicago and the university.
How long has the quartet been in existence?
The quartet was formed in late 1996 or 7. Our two violinists are founding members of the group. They were graduate students back then, and they and some classmates went to a summer music festival together as a preformed quartet and liked what they were doing and wanted to take it further. Spent a number of years in different graduate residency programs working with some of the leading quartets of the late 20th century, the Vermeer Quartet, the Emerson Quartet, the Juilliard Quartet. Those were all mentors to the Avalon Quartet in its early days. After that, the quartet secured its own faculty position at a small university in Indiana, and then our current position in DeKalb at Northern Illinois University, where we inherited a residency that had been held for 37 years by the Vermeer String Quartet, who had been our teachers in our early days. So that was a nice step for us.
A quartet forms a kind of a personality. There's there's a sound that the quartet develops because of the play between the players. When did you weren't there at the beginning,
right?
But you joined the group, I think, about 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so how did you come into that sound? Did you have to change what you do as a violist in order to adapt to what the quartet was when you joined?
Did I have to change? I don't know if I consciously changed things about my playing. I think quartet playing changes you. I think it can't help but mold your playing in a certain direction, whether or not you're even really aware of it. It certainly sharpens your skills. There's no form of music making that is more more exacting and demanding and elevating than quartet playing. So it's really it takes you to a higher level to be a full-time quartet player. I'm certainly a stronger player than I was when I first joined the group.
What's the nature of the demand?
You have to be aware of everything that you are doing down to the smallest level of detail, and everything that your colleagues are doing, and you have to be aware to exactly what degree you want to be matching, or you want to be bringing yourself out of the texture of the group, or supporting somebody else's part within the group. It's very intricate work, and it makes you listen to your own sound in a way that you don't have to, even when you're doing your own solo performing. There's much more liberty when you're a solo player, or certainly in the orchestra. Your sound just gets a little bit lost in the sea of sound around you, and you're not nearly as aware of what you're doing. I have a friend who for 8 or 10 years held a prominent cello seat in the Chicago Symphony, and left it to teach full time and to perform chamber music. And he said that you assume that when someone has joined the Chicago String Quartet, Chicago Symphony, they're probably at the height of their playing, but he said that after leaving the orchestra and playing chamber music full time, he was just so much more aware of detail in his sound, and so much more critical of himself in a good way. Exacting and demanding and refining way.
Over time, there must be a tremendous intimacy that develops among the four quartet members. Do you sense that?
Sure. Actually, audience member just the other day when we were playing this little informal concert at Horizon, the coffee shop, we took some Q&A afterwards, and a woman said, I noticed that you guys make much less eye contact than I expect to see from chamber musicians. Are you aware of that? Am I accurate with that, and why is that? And we said, yeah, you are right about that, because when you've been doing something for so long with the same people, you start to anticipate things. You can catch a lot of things peripherally that, if you are sitting down with someone for the first time, are much harder to follow. You have to be much more conscious in your eye contact and your physical communication. So you reach a certain point where things become, I don't want to say automatic, but it becomes second nature. It becomes much easier to respond even to a very small gesture or a very small nuance.
Visually, you're very exciting to watch, and part of that excitement comes from the fact that there are times when you all move at exactly the same instant. Mm-hmm. Your bodies are so totally coordinated to the music that you're playing that it's like you're taking a breath in at once and letting it out at once.
And that's not a conscious thing. That's never choreographed. That's just a natural outgrowth of trying to do the same thing the same way at exactly the same time. We're built really differently physically. If you look at the two violin players, there's a 6-foot-tall, very skinny guy and a much shorter woman, and obviously their hands are very different sizes, their bow arms are different lengths, and different things are more or less comfortable for the two of them technically. They have different ways of approaching the instrument. But when you have to match each other physically in the musical gesture, there's a natural outgrowth to that.
Which, and it's like watching a family somehow. It's almost like that.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you realize how literally you're speaking to the two violinists are a married couple in our group, and their two young kids are with us on the road here. So they were a couple before they were quartet colleagues, and then they decided to try playing together, and it has carried on for
And these are the 16. Two veterans of the group.
The two founding members of the two violinists.
And that would be Blaise Manieri and Marie Wong?
Right.
Yeah, okay. And then the other, the cellist is Cheng Hao Li.
Cheng Hao Li, yes.
Yeah, okay. You're going to play three Beethoven quartets Thursday evening. Beethoven wrote quartets through his entire musical career.
Right.
So when you play three quartets like this, do you arrange them consciously in some kind of time order? Do you do it that way, or is there a sense that this is earlier than that, then earlier than, is that part of the way you program it? Or?
Yeah. So Beethoven's quartet music, as with basically all of his music, is very clearly definable into three different segments, three different periods of his life. And musicologists have come up with the very imaginative reference of calling them the early period, the middle period, and the late period.
Clever. Yes.
It keeps it pretty simple. So our program on Thursday is going to take one piece from each of those time periods. And there are crystal clear stylistic differences between those different phases of his life. And when you take the entirety of his quartet output, which is 17 different pieces, when you look at it all at once, which we basically are doing over the past concert season, we've been performing the complete quartets of Beethoven, and when you look at the totality of the project, you can almost think of it or almost feel it as three different people, three different composers between the early quartets, the middle, and the late. There's a very classical sensibility in the early quartets, which are Beethoven's Opus 18 is a set of six string quartets. We'll be playing the sixth of those on Thursday. There's a very classical sensibility to these pieces that grows directly out of his influence by Haydn and Mozart and the classical masters that he followed. And then the middle period, which is a period of Beethoven's life that is probably most familiar to audiences, pieces like the Fifth Symphony and the Seventh Symphony and the very famous piano sonatas, most of these come from his middle period, the heroic period of Beethoven's writing, where even the intimate music, like quartets and the chamber music and the piano music, even that is on a grand symphonic scale. So on our concert on Thursday, we'll be performing Opus 59, number 2, from that middle period, which is a large-scale piece. It's a 35-minute string quartet, which would have been incomprehensible to Haydn when he was developing the genre, but Beethoven's really stretching the limits of what a quartet could do. Not just the size of the piece, but also the sound that the group has to produce takes on really orchestral proportions at times. And then in Beethoven's late period, which is really to me is the most fascinating period and the most rewarding to get to know. And this is something that a lot of casual fans of Beethoven don't even realize. We think of his Ninth Symphony as kind of the capstone of his career and his last great statement. But for the 3 years following that piece until he died, he turned his attention almost entirely to string quartet writing. There was an almost monk-like devotion to the string quartet, which is a medium that he had put down for about 10 years before that. He hadn't really done anything with quartet writing. He came back to it and poured all of his creative energy and attention into it and created these really far-reaching, really forward-looking pieces. There are some movements of late Beethoven quartets that the sensation of playing them, I think the only other music that I can compare it to is playing a Mahler symphony or a Strauss tone poem or a large early 20th century piece of music, which is, you know, a good 80, 90, 100 years after Beethoven was writing these late quartets. So really just way ahead of his time. And the late quartets are just so fascinating as a really intimate statement on Beethoven's behalf. So on Thursday, we're going to be performing Opus 133, which is also called the Grosse Fuge, or the Great Fugue, which is a single movement piece. It actually started out as the final movement of Beethoven's Opus 130 quartet. And it was so large and intimidating and confusing both to the listeners and also to the performers that Beethoven's publisher argued with him for a long time to come up with a different finale for this piece. And in a rare probably a completely unique example of deference on Beethoven's part. He relented and he agreed to write an alternate finale to the Opus 130 Quartet, and the publisher in return said that he would publish the Great Fugue as its own piece and that they would call it Opus 133, even though that wasn't how Beethoven had originally written it. So you often hear it performed as its own piece, and that's how we're going to be doing it Thursday night.
Wonderful. So we'll be able to hear the quartet perform these three pieces at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, May 10th. Tickets are still available around town. Thank you very much, Anthony, for coming down and sharing with us.
My pleasure.
Music, of course, by the Avalon String Quartet, here for the Music Festival and performing Thursday night at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church. My next guest is with me, and would you just talk right into one of those two microphones so that we can all hear about your book and your talk that's coming up? Anyway, my guest is Susan Chapman, and Susan is doing a program at the library, I believe. Is it tonight?
Thursday night.
Thursday, okay. And you have a fascinating background. You're talking about mindful communication.
Yes.
But when I was reading your biography, you are the amalgam of a Catholic education and a Buddhist centering as you grew older. And I wondered, does the mindful communication must grow out of both of those?
Yeah,
I think the focus is on the teachings that you've specialized in with Buddhism. But I wondered if that little dot of Catholicism that's back there in your background played a part.
Absolutely.
In
fact, I dedicated my book to the Mothers of the Sacred Heart and the Sakyongs of Shambhala, who are the two different main lineages. And I really felt like the nuns who educated me, who happened to be a lineage of 300-year-old group of women who were really committed to wakefulness, they had a lot to do with my background.
What is wakefulness?
What they taught me then and what I've been practicing since then is that every human being is either able to tune in to the present moment and kind of wake up to their basic goodness and to the goodness of what's going on, or we tend to kind of go to sleep and ignore that, and then we get caught in kind of a secondary process, which I call the red light. And that's when we are projecting other kind of past and future thoughts onto the present moment. So wakefulness really is a natural ability that we cultivate by coming back to the present moment.
How?
Good question. Well, what I'm doing in my book is really simplifying things as much as possible. And so what I'm saying is that every human being is born with three gifts: an awake body, a tender heart, and an open mind. And those three gifts are what I call a natural communication system. So we are naturally open to that. And so how is we train ourselves to come back to what we were born with and just relax into that?
The relax part is where I'm starting to have trouble.
Yeah, easier said than done.
Well,
yeah.
I think there's a lot of noise.
Yeah.
And getting it somehow, you can't make it go away. There's no way you can lock yourself into a soundproof room and still be in communication with someone else, unless you happen to be in a radio studio. But
right. It's interesting.
But as we sit here, I'm in charge of a big audio board and like that.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult sometimes to concentrate on what you're saying. And
yes,
I think that's true all the time.
That's absolutely right. And so that's why meditation is one of the main ways of working, because you start by developing communication within yourself. So you tune in to yourself by doing some form of meditation. And what meditation shows you, I know some kinds of meditation are about suppressing thoughts, But the kind of meditation I recommend is actually making room for thoughts so that they don't bug you. They're just like, you know, they just float around like fish in the sea. And you train yourself to not be carried away by the thoughts. But because you develop this kind of friendly relationship to your own mind, then it's really a lot easier to develop a friendly relationship in your conversations with other people. It's you know, especially when communication gets challenging and people start reacting to each other, which is, again, what I call the red light. I use the three lights, green light, yellow light, red light, as the main model for the communication.
I want to go back to that self-training part.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how do you train yourself to not, when I close my eyes and attempt to meditate, then there will be some thought that will pass through my mind. I wonder if I turned off the kitchen range, you know. And so there I am sitting there, and that thought comes right to the center and won't go away. How do you train yourself to let it swim past?
Well, it takes patience and it takes time, but what you actually do is as you relax, using a technique, we start off with a simple technique like coming back to your breath. Start off by having the awake body. Like if you have your body in a good listening position, like upright, paying attention, it's easier than when you're slouched and falling asleep. So you come back to your body. You come back using your breath to kind of restore your connection. Like right now, I'm coming back to looking at you. You're my object of connection. But when you're alone, you can use your breath. And what you actually notice is that the very first instant of nowness, there's just space. And then out of that comes that thought that says, I wonder if I turned off the kitchen, you know, the range. And that thought arises, and if you can actually just stay present right at that moment that the thought arises, that's where you just see it. It's just arising. It's just, it comes up over and over again. And it's a matter of whether you keep fixating on it or whether you just let it go. You know, and it takes time. You might think that thought 1,000 times, but the idea is it's always coming up fresh. It's not like a big solid thing.
There's a discipline here. In other words, part of this is that you're going to have to take the time to sit down and be quiet.
Definitely. It's like any relationship. If you want to have a happy relationship with a good friend and you do not make quality time, it won't happen. If you want to have a good relationship with your child and you don't have quality time, it won't happen. So that's really the main thing, is if you want to have a relationship with yourself, you have to make quality time. And it's not necessarily with your feet up on the coffee table having a beer, which is nice, but this is quality time to really listen and discerning the difference between discursive chatter that's just going nowhere versus actually genuinely getting in touch with how am I feeling, what's really happening for me. That's really what we mean by the awakefulness.
So, Susan, your book is called?
The Five Keys to Mindful Communication.
And you're going to be talking about that at the library.
At the library on Thursday.
Thursday evening. Okay.
And then we have a little workshop at the synagogue on the island, on Douglas.
Oh,
on Saturday.
Douglas. Okay,
yeah.
On Saturday. So what are the times? Do you know?
The library is 7 o'clock on Thursday, and then
Thursday
it's 9 to 5 on Saturday.
9 to 5 is the workshop at
workshop.
The synagogue.
Yeah.
Okay. And is there a charge for the workshop and all?
Yes, no. There is, but I can't even tell you right now
exactly
what it is.
It's probably a pay-at-the-door thing.
People can register going through the Shambhala Center.
Yeah.
Juno.shambhala.org.
Okay. On the website for the Shambhala Center.
Yeah.
Okay. And Susan, you're from Vancouver, right?
Currently, I grew up in Vancouver.
But you're a Junoite. You're a secret Junoite, right?
I feel like a Junoite because I moved here in 88 and I married into a Juno family. And we left in 2001, but when I'm back, I feel like I'm home. So I guess that qualifies in a way.
Well, welcome home.
Thank you. It feels that way, yeah.
We thank you for telling us about the program. And it's at Thursday night at 7 at the library, no charge for that. And then 9 to 5 at the synagogue out on Douglas. And there is a small charge for that, I would imagine.
Yeah, and Thursday I'll have books for sale and book signing. So
wonderful.
It's kind of a book event.
Well, again, welcome home. Glad we could have Juno weather for you while you're here.
Yeah, I was glad to see you too.
Recorded live at the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle, this
is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of May, 2012. It's the birthday of Edmund Wilson, born Red Bank, New Jersey, 1895, one of the most influential critics of the 20th century. His essays on Dickens and Kipling and Flaubert changed public perception of their work. He was very frank as a critic, did not care for the Carl Sandburg biographies of Lincoln. He said, "The cruelest thing that has happened to Lincoln since being shot by Booth was to have fallen into the hands of Carl Sandburg." And he once described Tolkien's Lord of the Rings as juvenile trash. It's the birthday of the poet Gary Snyder, born San Francisco, 1930, associated with the Beat Generation. He read at the famous Six Gallery reading in 1955 when Allen Ginsberg read Howl for the first time. Most of the Beats were city kids, and they were fascinated by Gary Snyder because he grew up in the woods of Washington and Oregon, and he knew the names of things, and he'd worked as a logger and a fire lookout. And he was a dedicated Zen Buddhist. Gary Snyder, who's lived in the same house since 1970, a house built by hand on a 100-acre plot of land in the Sierra Nevada. Snyder said, "We built it with a crew of boys and girls who were almost all in their first year out of college without any construction experience of any kind, all with hand tools and no electricity. Everyone was working, cleaning, cooking, and learning equally." The subtext is that the 60s sometimes worked. It's the birthday of the novelist Thomas Pynchon, born Glen Cove on Long Island, 1937, one of the most elusive and gifted writers of the 20th century, very few photographs of him in circulation. He went to Cornell, where it is rumored he studied with Nabokov, but couldn't understand what he was saying. The author of numerous novels, including V, Gravity's Rainbow, and Against the Day. His most recent book is Inherent Vice. His longtime friend Phyllis Gebauer donated the only known collection of signed first editions of Pynchon's work to the UCLA Extension Writers Program, and Pynchon sent a message to be read at the ceremony. He said, "I was planning to skydive into the middle of these proceedings. Thank you for your teaching." It's the birthday of the Irish novelist Roddy Doyle, born Dublin, 1958, author of the Barrytown trilogy, The Commitments, The Snapper, The Van, also the first Irish novelist to win the Booker Prize for his book Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. And it was on this date, 1970, the Beatles released their last album, Let It Be. They weren't happy with the mix, so Phil Spector took on the project, and the album was released a month after Paul McCartney announced he was leaving the band. In 2003, a new version was released that undid most of Phil Spector's work, a remix entitled Let It Be Naked. Here's a poem for today by Abigail Gramig, Requiem. Today is the perfect day, the sky just so, clouds moving fast, drops of water on leaves of Russian sage, dog sitting her chin on crossed paws, light streams through branches of locust tree. I sit just so at the small table. Everything is perfect, just like this, you would have said. Requiem, a poem by Abigail Gramig from her collection Dusting the Piano, published by Finishing Line Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Reputation.com, providing automated tools to monitor and manage a business's online reviews, because bad reviews can be bad for business. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, keep in touch.
It's 10 minutes before 4. You're in tune with KTOO News. My guests in the studio are Barbara Catiani Nelson and David Katzek, who are both here to talk about an environmental group, my environmental youth group that is part of the high school here in Juneau. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
If you pull that microphone down just a little bit, it'll pick your voice up better. Thank you. Anyway, so tell me about this Hind Latini. What does that mean?
Hind Latini came from a group of elders who met with people from the Forest Service, Park Service, and others when they were going to develop this project. It wasn't an environmental group. It was basically an educational group that was going to look at the sciences as it relates to the earth and so forth. And Hind means water. Latini means one who observes, one who is cognizant and aware of the type of things that are happening with the water. And it was very important in our traditions and our customs because water was very, very important to not just Tlingit people, but all living things. Water was really important. And so we had people who watched the water, who were people who were caretakers of the water. And our culture has a lot of, like, for example, the box of daylight. In that particular story, the man had control of the lights and so forth and so on. But there was a person who was the watcher, the one who was the steward of the water, so that this man's children, or they would not get sick from the water that they had. And so there was a person who had to watch the water. So they were caretakers of the water. They were observers. But they also had to learn about the water as well.
So
that's how the name came into being.
In our culture, we'd call that a scientist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So are there other cultural scientists? Are there other Tlingit scientists who had responsibility for other parts of the world?
Yes, there is. There's scientists in the area of biology as it relates to the salmon, with respect to geology as it relates to the rocks and the earth, glaciology as it relates to the glacier, forestry, as it relates to the forest in this particular land that we call Tlingit Ani, which is southeast Alaska. And I think what I would like to do is just turn it over also to Barbara Kedianti to share a little background information on this, and then we can continue on if that's okay with you.
Good, that's wonderful. Barbara, so how does the school come into this program?
Well, thank you. First of all, we were invited into collaborating with the Tlingit and Haida Central Council and the U.S. Forest Service, and as a district employee, I'm the liaison and project lead for Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and so we readily accepted the invitation to help raise the level of knowledge, local knowledge, traditional knowledge with, as you termed it, Western science. And that was in our interest in that as we integrate the knowledge, then our students, all students, benefit from knowing place in a different, more intimate way. David spoke about Hind Latini being a U.S. Forest Service project in general. And as I know, and I'm probably misstating the number, there are over 8 experimental forests in the nation, over 80. And it may be as many as 120, but Hind Latini is one that's in our area, very special. And this is where the United States Forest Service intends to create a new science, if you will, with the integration of traditional knowledge and also come to understand the ecosystem. The students that were involved in this particular project were tasked with asking the question, how does climate change impact our traditional way of life? We wanted to push that issue to give them a sense of their role and purpose and understanding the environment, understanding the landscape so as to become conversant in it and also to better be prepared to be a steward of this place that we call home.
And the thing of it is Barbara was sharing, and we're both sitting here this afternoon. Thank you very much for giving us this brief opportunity to share with you a little bit. Back in 1980, the elders came together in Sitka in May, right about this time. And one of the things that came down was the Sealaska Corporation was meeting with the elders of their corporation and wanted to know what they might be able to do to help them. And so they had an elders conference in Sitka. During that particular time, they had all kinds of suggestions that the corporation might consider to help them, higher dividends, housing, health, and the list goes on with respect to the kind of things that they wanted. When they came to the last few days, the corporation said, "We wish we could do all these things. But if there was any one particular thing that you would like for us to do, what would it be?" And there they said, "Ha yatke hatachankiyan hasabuskuwu hastuslingit dot awe hatuwashigu hasabuskuwu." What they said, the one thing we want them to know, our children and our grandchildren to know, is we want them to know about who they are, where they're from, and this included a whole lot of different things. And since that particular time, it's kind of coincidental, but I don't necessarily think that Barbara Kedianti Nelson and myself have been working to the same beat, the drum beat, of what the elders wanted to see happen for their children to learn about the fact that their people knew about the sciences of the land just like any other scientist. That science was science. What was right was right. For example, one time I saw someone holding a rock in their hand and they dropped the rock and they said, "This is the law. Whether what color skin you have, if you're holding the rock and you drop it, it's, the law will be that the gravity will pull it to the ground." And so science is science. And our people learned about that. And there are words that we use. We say, for example, listen to the trees. And someone who doesn't understand that may think, "Oh, you guys are really weird, man. They listen to the trees." But the scientists, when the scientist begins to look at the tree, he or she has to listen to what the tree is telling them. And some of you, "Oh, the trees are talking to you?" When you listen to the scientist talk, they're going to say, "Those rocks tell us a story. That glacier tells us a story." When the scientist says that, that is phenomenal. But when a Tlingit person says that, that is prehistoric. That's not very intelligent. "Oh, the trees talk? The mountain talks?" That's not education. That's ignorance. Because everything on this earth speaks to us and tells us. The weather tells us the kind of things that we are doing to this earth. It speaks to us. And so these are pretty heavy type of things to say. I didn't necessarily plan on saying that, but I feel it's important to say that. Here's the other thing. These kids are so excited about knowing that the Tlingit people had just as much scientific knowledge as some of these individuals with PhDs. We have it in our vocabulary. We have words in our vocabulary to be able to tie it with.
Unfortunately, we're running very close to out of time. So the program involves a youth group of high school students. It's run through the junior highs and high schools here in town.
That's
and
cool.
Barbara, you're coordinating it as far as the school side.
I'm one of the partners in this endeavor.
Well, it seems to me this is a wonderful extension of education that's really perfectly suited to Southeast Alaska and our awareness that and our integration with the Native culture. Thank you so much for coming down and telling us about this.
Thank you for the existence
of this program. You're in tune with KTOO News. It's a couple of minutes after. It's about a minute after 4. We are translated on several translators through the area. We're on 104.3 FM downtown. We're on 103.1 in the Valley and Auk Bay on K276 AF. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on 101.7 on K269 AO. Gustavus is on 102.1 at 88.1. And K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9.